Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Letras Libres presenta Ciberdiálogos con León Krause.
Queridos amigos, ¿cómo están? Bienvenidos una vez más a Ciberdiálogos. Soy León Krause. Gracias por escuchar nuestro podcast. Si nos están siguiendo en el podcast, en nuestras plataformas, o si nos están siguiendo en este momento a través de nuestro videoblog en YouTube de Ciberdiálogos, gracias por escucharnos y por vernos. El día de hoy, una conversación de verdad para mí memorable. Tuve la oportunidad de hablar con Quinn McHugh. Ella es la directora ejecutiva de Artículo 19. Tantos temas que tocar con Quinn. Hablamos, por supuesto, de la batalla global por la libertad de expresión en estos tiempos en el que la libertad de expresión está bajo un ataque constante, cotidiano. Hablamos de la situación en algunos países en específico y, por supuesto, tocamos México, en donde en los últimos días Artículo 19 ha sido objeto de un ataque directo desde el poder, directo incluso desde la boca del presidente Andrés Manuel López Obrador. ¿Qué piensa la mujer que encabeza Artículo 19 de lo que está pasando en el mundo con la libertad de expresión, con los retos que enfrenta el periodismo, con los ataques directos en muchos casos desde el escritorio de los poderosos? De esto y más hablé con Quinn McHugh. La conversación en inglés con subtítulos en nuestro sitio de internet en YouTube a continuación. Quinn, I think it's important to begin with the basics. What does Article 19 do? What does the organization actually do?
Article 19 is an international organization dedicated to the promotion of freedom of expression and access to information around the world, particularly the protection of journalists.
From what?
From a number of the increasing attacks that we see. Article 19 look at defending freedom of expression from a variety of perspectives, from a legal perspective, from a policy perspective, and look at the protection of the activists who face aggression because of what they're doing to use those rights of their voice. So that sometimes comes in the form of attacks from the government on activists. It comes in terms of legal attacks as companies sue journalists or activists for the work that they're doing. And sometimes it comes in the form of physical attacks, in terms of helping with security and emergency support for people that are actively being assaulted for the work that they do to promote free information flow around the world.
You mentioned activists and journalists. What's the difference?
Well, I think some people would say that maybe the line is becoming a little bit blurred with opinion journalism on the rise around the world. But from our perspective, a journalist is someone that seeks to, in a neutral and unbiased way, put forward information that adds richness and value to public discourse. And they try and do this in a manner that, again, adds to the quality of information in the environment, allow people to make good choices. I would say an activist is someone who's really trying to push forward a strong opinion about the need to support human rights.
In any case, both deserve protection.
Yes, both deserve protection, and under international law and most national laws around the world, they are accorded that protection.
As you know, Mexican President López Obrador, he's not the first certainly, and will not be the last, has tried to discredit Article 19 by questioning its financing. Who finances Article 19? Who's behind it?
Well, Article 19 has always been transparent about the sources of our funding. We receive funding from the main people and organizations and governments around the world that support a positive human rights agenda. So those are, in terms of our global funding, the majority of our funding comes from donor governments who also provide bilateral funding support, as well as private foundations. So foundations like the Ford Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, and other the main international funders for human rights work, which tend to be northern governments.
Article 19 is conservative. It follows the values of the right. Is this true?
That is one of the more... I'm laughing. I shouldn't laugh. It's one of the more entertaining and the more concerning narratives that's out there. You know, I think in particular the attack that's been directed against our Mexican affiliate, our Mexican office. I think that the governments of Felipe Calderón and Enrique Peña Nieto would find it quite amusing to have us be considered a conservative organization, considering we approach freedom of expression from the viewpoint of the right itself. It's not a conservative or a liberal right. It's a fundamental right that all citizens are accorded under international and national law.
So you're not from the right, you're for rights.
Yes, we're not. That's a good way of putting it. We're not from the right, we are for rights.
Okay, I'll give it to you free of charge. Does Article 19 have any political agenda?
The only agenda that we have is the agenda that we are very clear about in our mission, which is to further the promotion and protection of the rights to freedom of expression and access to information. And we're very clear about this. We put it forward from a policy perspective. We try and push forward a progressive agenda to ensure that the most people around the world have access to these rights and all the things that come from it. So the ability to hold decision makers to account, the ability of individuals to get access to health, access to water, access to food, all of those things that come from being able to get access to information and then being able to act on it themselves.
In a different time, when defending independent and critical journalism was in his interest, Mexican President López Obrador, when he was head of the opposition, defended the craft, the journalist, and Article 19's work as well. Now, when journalists focus on him and his administration, he tends to do, let's say, the opposite. Now journalists are, and I quote, a mafia. What do you make of this dynamic?
The thing that's most disturbing about this dynamic, as you point out, is that it's increasingly the same dynamic and the same kind of language that we hear coming from authoritarian governments around the world, that people who have a different viewpoint and the press in particular, when they call out government's failings, which is the role of a free press, to ensuring accountability, is to brand them as the enemy. You know, we saw this very clearly in the United States, as you're all too aware, with Donald Trump saying that the press was the enemy of the people. And I would suggest that the president of Mexico maybe look at seeing, is that really the way that you want to portray people who are trying to just do their jobs in terms of getting the information for citizens out there? Are we really the enemy of the people? I would say that we're not, and that actually we should be working more closely to protect organizations like Article 19 and like the journalists themselves, who are trying to ensure the best quality information to the public at a time of real serious trials around the world.
We have seen, as you mentioned, this dynamic in other places, and this is part of a trend. It has happened since forever. Whenever a journalist or a news organization is uncomfortable to power, but recently it has gotten much worse. I was thinking of just a brief list, and of course you mentioned the United States, but we could say that it happens in many other places: Turkey, Hungary, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Brazil. The list is really quite long. How do you explain it? What drives this narrative? Why do people in power, these authoritarian or proto-authoritarian regimes, turn to labeling journalists as the other, the antagonist, the enemy? Why?
First, I would like to just note one of the things that you've said about the increasing trend that we're seeing in terms of these attacks on journalists. I want to point out that last year, Article 19's annual Global Expression Report pointed out that for the first time, the majority of the population in the world live in countries where freedom of expression is in a crisis state. 51% of the world's population live in countries where those rights are actively eroded by their governments. And an additional 28% live in places where expression is restricted or highly restricted. This is the worst case that we've seen in the past 20 years. And just to say that it's not just in individual countries, it's something that's happening, I think, particularly globally. In terms of the question that you asked about why we're seeing this happening, I'd like to maybe direct people to look at another report which just came out from the Varieties of Democracy Index, or the VDENT Index, which is compiled by the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, which looks at kind of the state of democracy in the world. And one of the things that the report highlights this year is the increasing rate of authoritarianism and the rise of autocracy. And the thing that they link to, the precursor, and actually almost a predictive force, is the rise of autocracy is almost always preceded by attacks on freedom of expression, freedom of the press. Mm-hmm. And the reason that you see that is because a lot of the autocratization that we're seeing root themselves in populist narratives. But in order for those narratives to really be taken forward, you have to control the information environment in a country. You need people to back up and to continue echoing what you say. You have to create your own narrative of success. And the way that governments have found of doing this is by controlling the media, by demonizing and stigmatizing those critical voices, by pushing them out, by making it illegal to report. We've seen this a lot in the past year under the pandemic restrictions that have been put in place. So while it's been a trend for a while, in the past year, it's gotten significantly worse as governments have now branded people that even question whether they're doing a good job in terms of their vaccine rollouts or fighting the pandemic as enemies of the public for just questioning whether or not demonstrably bad performance has been bad performance. And again, it's all part of that control of the narrative that is fundamental to authoritarian governments maintaining their political control.
That's fascinating and terrifying. What surprises me as a factor in this struggle that you're describing is that now we have news outlets, and not marginal news outlets, but very important news outlets, if we can call it, by the way, news outlets, that that go along with this effort to discredit the press. I can think, of course, of the example of Fox News. And then I think of other actors, state-controlled actors who follow state interests, like Russia Today, for example. What do you make of that part of the equation? Of course, Fox News and Russia Today are different examples, but what do you make of that part of the equation that you're describing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting to look at it in terms of the more of the state-controlled media, as you know, and I would actually categorize kind of, you know, Russia Today and those more in that category, and those for whom they have determined that there's a clear economic interest in division. And I would say that, for example, Fox News in the United States, I think there's some examples of Rupert Murdoch's media empire in Australia that people point to as well.
Let me interrupt you. So you would say that with Fox News, the incentive is finances. It makes for good business to do this kind of thing, drives great ratings. So who cares about the political or cultural or societal consequences? It's good business, let's do it.
I think that's a cynical way of looking at it, but I think you can't look at it any other way from my perspective, that there's a particular business incentive. And in fact, the incentive that you see in Fox News is not that dissimilar from the incentives that people are using to attack the decisions and the information sharing, for example, that happens on Facebook or on YouTube, which is that engagement drives attention, which drives investment, which drives advertising. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, divisive or sensationalistic content drives engagement and drives the money. And so Fox News has been very good at finding a particular political viewpoint that is highly divisive and really touches something core in people in terms of saying that you're right, the rest of the world is wrong, you have the special knowledge, you're the ones that know. That, I think, drives that continues to drive that division. And I think it's clear that has not really been of necessarily a concern about what that means for democracy. And that would be one of the things I think that we would call for, is for people to really think about, if you're looking at engagements and looking at fundamental norms, really think hard about whether or not this largest news outlet in the United States wants to have it as their business model to continue to drive content that is deliberately trying to separate people.
Now, I interrupted you when you were beginning to describe Russia today, because I wanted to draw a couple of distinctions, one of them being the financial interest, the clickbait aspect of what Fox News is doing versus what Russia Today is doing. Because clearly the interest of the Russian government that is behind Russia Today is not necessarily financial. It is different. It is political influence. Could you explain to us what Russia Today is about?
Well, I'm not a specific expert on Russia Today, but I believe that one of the charges that have been put forward about Russia Today is, as you said, it's state-funded, and it seems to be state-funded to drive a particular political, geopolitical agenda of the Russian government. So some of the things that they have put out, I think people would tend to categorize slightly more on the propaganda angle than just outright trying to drive engagement. I think that's partly the reason that, I believe it was, what, a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, it was categorized as like a foreign agent under the U.S. kind of foreign influencing laws and required to register as a foreign agent in the United States. I would say that we have a problem with the way that news agencies in general have been categorized as foreign agents. And so that's not necessarily something I'm supporting, but just trying to explain why it was viewed that was a step that would be taken. I think Sputnik is probably a more extreme example of Russia Today, for example, in terms of putting forward more kind of official government narratives as opposed to clear news.
The strategy to discredit the press, whether it be from power or with the help of some quote-unquote news organizations or a propaganda machinery or social media, whatever, has been sadly pretty successful. Only 48% of Americans, in a couple of polls I saw, only 48% of people in the United States trust traditional media, less than half. 56%, and this really broke my heart, this second statistic, 56% think reporters mislead people in a frequent basis, right? We do it frequently. Those are alarming numbers.
It is. It's incredibly alarming, and it reflects, I think, a considered and sustained attack on the credibility of the media for a long time. It's also, I think, reflective of the state we find ourselves in right now, which is that people, and it's partly related to social media, but partly, I think, related to just the overall glut of information that's out there, is that people tend to prioritize information that they hear from friends and contacts as more true than things that they hear from outside sources. And so I think one of the challenges for kind of the traditional media and traditional press is to look at how they can make it more into that kind of news stream that people are supporting and sharing with each other more directly. Because I think it's one of the, what's the best way of kind of saying this? I think one of the real challenges that we see in the United States, and I think it's happening more globally as well, which really impacts on this view negatively of the press, has been the decline of local reporting. I mean, if you look at the states in the United States right now, it's thousands and thousands of local news outlets that would report on, you know, the local high school hockey games or what's happening in the town council or things that really matter to people in their own communities. They've almost entirely disappeared in a number of places, the financing has not there.
And have been replaced, these local outlets. And I'm very familiar with it because part of what I do is working for one on Univision in Los Angeles, a local news station. So I get exactly what you're saying, although I think you're also referring to small local newspapers and the like. These local news outlets have been replaced in people's lives in these small towns by Facebook, by social media?
Yes. Well, I think by Facebook, by social media, people have viewed the creation of, I think, online outlets is a lot cheaper. But I think you also see that there's news deserts that have really happened in the United States now, where basically the local Facebook community has replaced the local media outlet, whether it's the independent newspapers or whether it's the local affiliates. And as a result of that, you know, people trust those who they know. You know, people trust the people in their communities. They would trust the local journalists, and so they would think better about them than they would otherwise. It's this weird thing that you see in the United States where people hate Congress but like their congressman, you know? So with the breakdown of that connection between people and journalists at the local level, that's just allowed them to say more broadly that I think that, you know, the media is corrupt because they don't have that direct experience with it and see how people are working to actually put forward information. It's too easy to then fall into the broader narratives that different political actors have about this is good information and this is bad information.
Yeah, and just there's just one more step towards conspiracy theories and that's sort of QAnon rabbit hole. So what's the way out for journalists? What's the way out for our craft? Let me make the 6,000. What is it? $64,000 question? Is it?
the old game show.
I think it's way more than that. But let me ask you. How can we regain the public's trust? Where do we begin?
Well, I think for me, it has to start at the local level. And one of the things I think that we're seeing that perhaps has some promise is the creation of kind of nonprofit news. So news is not designed to kind of make a profit, that doesn't respond to shareholders, that isn't subject to, you know, hedge funds buying them and then stripping assets and then selling it out, but really looking at how can you finance things who is an information that is basically a public benefit in terms of providing that. So I think looking at the nonprofit news model and building that at a local level and trying to build up from there will regain the trust of individuals. I live in Washington, D.C., so while I appreciate that Jeff Bezos has purchased the Washington Post and is investing in the Washington Post, I don't think we should be looking to kind of oligarchs to save the news media. I think this is something where the media itself needs to reestablish those relationships and connections with people in terms of what's important to them and where they live. And that, to me, again, starts with this looking at the financing of the media in general and points to, again, the need to have sustainable, probably nonprofit sources of self-funding of the media around the world. And also making better use of, there's another thing that I think that more digital natives are very good at, which is really exploiting the way that systems of information are set up online to kind of drive content. And I think that there's a better way to kind of look at engagement and driving engagement and making use of some of those tricks for kind of traditional or more basic journalistic sources that haven't really been invested in to date as much. I think the larger news organizations are, but the smaller ones just haven't had a chance of doing that.
Very few news organizations have had the luxury of responding to these threats by hiring more reporters. The Washington Post, for which I work, full disclosure, is one of them, certainly. The reaction after Trump came to power was to hire more people, more reporters. The New York Times, in its own way, has done the same. But many news outlets around the world simply have not been able to do that because, I mean, journalism is not really expensive necessarily, but journalists have to get paid. And producing these pieces on paper and online even is expensive in a way. It costs something. So this question of financing journalism And how do we pay journalists? How do we convince people that it's worthwhile to pay $10 a month for a great podcast or for mm-hmm. a subscription to The Atlantic or to Letras Libres? How do we convince people that this is worthwhile if people think, you know what, the New York Times is exactly the same as the whatever flag time news that I see on my Facebook feed? How do we need to educate people? I hate that verb in this context, but do we have to educate people as to what the news media, the press, actually does for society?
I think that's, again, I think seeing the term educate always gets a little bit challenging, as you say. But I do think that there's emphasis that needs to be put on, again, as you say, it is on the value to society. And I think that one of the hardest things that the media can do, and again, this relates to the rise of authoritarianism, is people respond to the calls of anti-corruption and investigative reporting and looking for places of hypocrisy. And I think those are some of those areas where people can start rebuilding the sense that the media serves a public interest by investing more in this. I'm saying this in a meta sense. In terms of the individual kind of on the ground sense, I'm thinking about, you know, journalists in Africa who are paid virtually nothing and have to have significant side hustles in order to make ends meet and don't actually have the ability of sustaining themselves as journalists. And so there's a couple of different things on that from the global perspective. One, if you look at the investment that has been put into media development from governments or from international donors, it's excessively small sliver of the amount of money that goes into the development of compared to infrastructure or other things. But if you think about it, the single thing that allows for business stability and business investment is feeling that you have a secure business environment where there are lower levels of corruption and that information is sound. And so I think we need to switch the idea that media is like some kind of luxury into thinking of it as a fundamental precursor of democracy and capitalism itself, and ensure that there is sufficient support for it at that level.
This might sound like I'm going back to a previous question, but you made me think of what I heard recently in this podcast from a journalist in El Salvador. And he explained to me how the Bukele government, and by the Bukele government in El Salvador, I am referring specifically to Bukele himself, because it's that kind of government. It is the president, and that's about it. He is the most powerful president in the continent of America, period. This is a fact. And what he has done with journalists, especially independent critical journalists, is he has placed them in this box, and this box has the label opposition, antagonists. How do we combat that? It is a daily struggle for journalists there, but it happens all around the world. For Article 19, how do you combat that? This sort of continuous daily onslaught from power that aims to discredit journalists and place them as opposition.
It's incredibly challenging, particularly when a president has such a major microphone or such a significant soapbox, and so many people look to authority figures for cues as to how to view the rest of society. I think the only thing that the journalists, well, not the only thing, but a key thing for journalists is to not necessarily, it's very difficult, but to not necessarily think that because I'm being branded as opposition by a person, I should act as opposition. You know, so to keep going to demonstrate that the information that we're putting out is, again, relevant to individuals at their local lives. So it's about access to water. It's about access to health. It's about calling out kind of corruption and demonstrating that. I think the case of Alexei Navalny in Russia is a very interesting one to look at mm-hmm. in that regard, because, I mean, he's clearly been branded as like the opposition and put in a box and is dying in prison right now as a result of it. But he's been put in that category because his anti-corruption message has had real impact in Russia and is really cutting into the way that people view the leaders of the country by calling out the excesses of those in power. And I think that is something that resonates very well with people, is the idea that maybe people are taking things away from me and my life and my livelihood in order to kind of enrich themselves. That is, I think, a universal call and something that journalism does incredibly well, which is finding those areas of hypocrisy and corruption and exposing them. So I just would say that
focus on reporting.
Focus on reporting and also focus on where it's going to matter for the individuals when it comes to their own lives. You know, one of the things that is, speaking about the Washington Post, I was listening to kind of a local radio show talking about the history of kind of journalism, local journalism. And you mentioned that the Post has, after the Trump administration came in, the Post invested in more reporters. But they were contrasting the case now and the number of people that work on like the local desks in the Washington region mm-hmm. with the state, 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, they had, you know, several hundred people who were working on just reporting what was happening in all the suburbs and all the cities and stuff around Washington, D.C. And now it's just, you could count them in like two hands, basically, maybe three hands. Like, it's a very small number. And when that happens, it's really easy to make the case that media just cares about these big issues, but they don't really care about what's happening in people's backyards. And that, I think, is one of the most powerful tools that journalists have, is to really show that they do care about what's happening to people on an individual level, and that their reporting is reflective of that.
Let me ask you, as we approach the end of our conversation, about social media, the great protagonist of our times in many ways. So we know that social media is wonderful in many ways. It democratizes communication, livens the conversation. But it's also a hub for misinformation, and the consequences can be severe. Electoral interference, campaigns against vaccines. So when you look at the fight for freedom of expression, trustworthy information, and everything that we've been describing, is social media on the right side of history?
I would say that social media can be on the right side of history, but we have to get to a place where we move beyond the idea that the antidotes to bad speech is more speech, and realize that this is a fundamental good, almost a public utility that needs regulation. So social media can be there, but they need to get on board with the idea that there needs to be regulation of their business practices in order to ensure that they are on the right side of history going forward.
How should social media be regulated? Because then you enter into a whole different discussion as to whether governments should govern the internet, and you see what's happened in China, and you see what's happening now in Russia with Twitter. How should they be regulated? What's close to an ideal model?
Well, our ideal model is something that we have proposed, which we're calling kind of the social media councils, which is modeled on the idea of kind of the independent press council models that you've seen in Europe, which are independent entities. They're not run by the social media companies themselves. They're not run by governments. They're multi-stakeholder places where you have representatives of the companies, you have representatives of media, you have representatives of stakeholders that actually are able to come up with kind of self-regulatory structures to say what is the way that we're going to operate and evaluate different cases as they come up in terms of problematic or not. And so we actually think that the best model is one that takes a cue from kind of the self-regulatory space in the past, and really think that the social media companies can be part of that dialogue as to how they should be operating, as well as involving government and civil society, as well as journalists going forward. So it's not a heavy-handed government approach. It's more of a kind of middle range, kind of multi-stakeholder approach to regulation.
That's a fascinating idea. So one last thing, López Obrador's attacks on journalists don't happen in a void in Mexico. It's just a fact. It is one of the most dangerous countries in the world to be a journalist, maybe the most dangerous country in the world to be a journalist. In that context, what are the consequences of a constant attack on the press from those in power?
I think the data from Mexico points to the very real and very personal cost that comes from those attacks of people on power. We just came out with a report, our Mexican annual report, which showed that in the past year, there were 692 cases of attacks on journalists. That comes down to one attack every 13 hours. And in nearly all those cases, there's been utter impunity for the perpetrators of those attacks. And so you see that people are being sued and being driven out of the role of journalists. They're being physically attacked. They're being murdered. Their families are under attack, their colleagues. And the overall environment mm-hmm. is such that you have actual news deserts in some places in Mexico where there is no reporting, there is no information that can come in because journalists have been driven out. And people are afraid to step into the void that's left there because they know they're going to come under attack by both the powerful and from private interests, whether they're drugs or otherwise there. And so that is the environment in which making a statement that the press are enemies, it just continues to fuel the attacks against people who are just trying to do their jobs and trying to demonstrate that they are key agents of holding the powerful to account.
You mentioned in the recent report, you reference López Obrador's daily press conferences and what they add or subtract from a healthy media environment, a healthy public discussion in Mexico.
The daily press conferences are a very interesting phenomenon. One of the things that we put forward in our report is that instead of adding to an environment of transparency, they have actually, unfortunately, muddied the waters and have become a vehicle for misinformation because of the outsized domination of those press conferences in the overall media and reporting environment in Mexico. That's a real concern that we have.
Thank you, Quinn.
Thank you.
Amigos, gracias por escuchar Ciberdiálogos. Los invito a apoyarnos siguiéndonos, suscribiéndose al podcast y regalándonos estrellas, calificaciones positivas en las distintas plataformas en donde nos encuentran. De esa manera, más personas podrán hallar estos Ciberdiálogos. Hasta la próxima. Soy León Krause.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.